study of Mark. We're going to be in chapter 9, and we're going to go to verses 1 through 13. But before we go to the text, is this working? Am I on? Are we good?
I want to tell a little story. Maybe you've probably not heard the story. I didn't know the story before until recently, and obviously it's a made-up story. But the devil had a garage sale. Did you know this? The devil had a garage sale. And he must have had duplicates of some of his favorite tools because he decided he'd have a garage sale and offer some through his garage sale. So he has a shelf in his garage, and he's lined up some of his favorite tools that he likes to use and put a little price tag on each one. And on the shelf over here on this side of his garage, he's got lust, and he's got pride, and he's got the tool of anger, and he's got the tool of jealousy, and the tool of envy, greed, all of his favorite tools that he's used. And I don't know who his neighbors are. I don't know why you'd want to be the neighbor of the devil, but maybe they're coming by and checking out what he's got in his garage sale. And then on the other side of the garage, he's got another shelf, and there's one other tool on this side on a shelf, and it's really old and worn out. Obviously, it's been used a lot. And as his neighbors are looking at these tools on the shelves, they're looking at the prices the devil's put on each one of these, and they realize, boy, this one over here, he's asking a lot of money for this one. Far more than all the others. And yet it's so worn out. And what could it possibly be good for? The neighbor asks the devil this question, and the devil says, well, you're looking at my favorite tool of all. He said, I use this one all the time. He said, it's worn out because I've used it on everyone. And it's worked so, so well. And so that's why I'm asking so much to sell it. Well, what is that tool? What's it called? So that's the tool of discouragement. The tool of discouragement. Did you know that discouragement is a tool of the devil? One that he likes to use the most. And one of the reasons he likes it so much is because we don't realize he's even using it. And if any of you don't struggle with discouragement or haven't had a problem with discouragement recently, I give you permission to leave or to play on your phone for the rest of the service. But the rest of you, if the devil's tried discouragement in your life, I'd suggest you listen, because we have something important we need to learn. Discouragement's a serious, serious problem that we all struggle with. And we can blame it on a lot of things. We could say, well, it's winter's dragging on. It snowed again. Or it's those people I have to work with every day. My boss is unreasonable. Or the people that I'm trying to oversee won't listen. Or it's the classmates that I can't get along with. Or, go on down the list. But one of the things we've got to remember is it's ultimately something that the devil is trying to work on you with. And so we need God's help to resist this. And here in chapter 9 of Mark, we're going to find that the disciples are in a cloud of discouragement. They're in a cloud of discouragement. Remember last week, the shock they got at the end of chapter 8. Jesus gave them some very discouraging news. He had said that, he's going to die. He said that he's going to suffer, that he's going to be rejected, and ultimately he's going to die. Now, he's been showing them all along his power, his majesty, his authority, and they've been so impressed with who he is. But we're at the hinge of the gospel. Here in Mark, the hinge is right here between 8 and 9, and we go from the first half where Jesus' power is on display to now the second half where his weakness is on display. And these disciples are trying to figure out what Jesus is talking about. Instead of him saying, if you come after me, you're going to have a really cool robe to wear. You're going to get this really great throne to sit on. We're going to give you this whole section of the kingdom. He says to his disciples, if you come after me, you're going to have to deny yourself, and you're going to have to take up your cross, and you're going to have to follow me, and I'm going to die. So you know where this is leading. Not what they expected. This isn't what Peter signed up for. He rebukes Jesus to his face. Jesus rebukes him right back, says, get behind me, Satan. You think Satan's involved in this? He's trying to hinder the mission. That's what the devil does. He's trying to shut things down, and that's why he loves discouragement so much. I found this great article by John Bloom. He wrote, it's called Don't Let Discouragement Choke You. He writes, discouragement's sense of defeat and hopelessness saps us of energy and vision. It can consume a lot of time. It can keep us from doing what we need to do because we don't want to face it. And it can even be contagious, weakening the faith of others. When we feel discouraged, we want comfort, which is right to feel. But the comforts we often turn to are ways to avoid our fears rather than ways to muster our courage to face and overcome them. When this happens, discouragement simply becomes sinful indulgence and unbelief, no different than indulging in lust or anger or other sins of unbelief. So Jesus sees what the disciples can't. He sees how Satan's trying to wedge in here with a spirit of discouragement to shut down the mission, to prevent them from carrying on with what Jesus has called them to do. He knows that the disciples are going to have to be encouraged in order to overcome this. So let's look now at chapter 9 and beginning in verse 1. And he said to them, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. Now, some people are confused by this verse. They think, well, Jesus must have been wrong, that he was going to return again before the disciples died, but that's not really what he's talking about here. I think what he's talking about is that he is going to rise from the dead. That is going to be the power on display, that his rising from the dead is going to be the evidence that there has been a victory won. But they have to wait to see this. Verse 2, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. Stop right there. Notice the time frame. After 6 days. Now, in Mark's gospel, 6 days is like an eternity. Remember, this is the gospel where everything goes fast. Everything happened immediately. The disciples are shooting back and forth across the lake and trying to catch a little sleep in the boat when there's not a storm. Everything has been moving at a breakneck pace, and then all of a sudden we get to the hinge of the gospel, and they take a six-day break, and they're pondering this thing Jesus told them about his death and about their need to take up a cross and this discouragement. You just sense this cloud of discouragement descending on them. So Jesus selects 3 of the 12, the inner circle, Peter, James, and John, and he says, let's take a walk. A long walk, up a high mountain, it says. And the Bible often tells us that big things happen on the tops of high mountains. And so we know something is coming. But remember Moses. Moses had 40 years of discouragement in the wilderness as he was shepherding sheep, wondering, what's God going to do with my life? When he went up on Mount Horeb and met God at the burning bush. Remember Elijah, also in the wilderness, deeply distressed, deeply discouraged, deeply depressed because he's being hunted down and there's an effort to kill him. And then he encounters the whisper of God there at the cave in the wilderness. Both Elijah and Moses, embattled leaders who struggled with discouragement, they struggled with understanding God's mission and God's call in their lives. They felt rejected. And they both came to a place where they were ready to give up, to throw in the towel. And now Peter, James, and John are in this same kind of position, this same place of discouragement. Jesus brings them up on a mountain, knowing mountains are where people meet God. And look what happens next. Verse 2 says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, led them up a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. Jesus is transfigured, brilliant light. His clothes are beaming. And not only that, there's Moses next to him and Elijah beside him. Now, I'm not sure how they knew these guys were Moses. Did they wear name tags? I mean, did they have children's storybook Bibles that showed them what they looked like? Or did you just, when you see Moses, you know that's Moses. I'm not sure. But Moses and Elijah are there. Peter is overwhelmed by this. It says in verse 5, Peter says to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Peter, when he doesn't know what to say or do, just says something and just starts doing something. But they're amazed and terrified and in awe of what they see. And then, if that weren't enough, Jesus glowing, Moses and Elijah on each side, now there's this cloud and this voice. Verse 7, a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved son. Listen to him. Now the very voice of God the Father comes to them in this moment of glory. This is a day like nothing else they've ever seen before. This is a vision like nothing they've ever had. And then verse 8. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. Lights out. The curtain drops. The end has come. And all of a sudden, it's like back to where they were before. Verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what this rising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him. Now, I'm not going to dwell long on this particular section, except to say that Jesus says here Elijah has come, and it likely means here he's referring to John the Baptist. Now, John the Baptist was not a reincarnation of Elijah, but he had the spirit of Elijah. That prophetic mantle of Elijah was upon John the Baptist, and they killed him. And they're going to kill Jesus too. But the point here is that this curtain, while they were on the mountain, has been drawn back, and they have seen the glory of God in a profound and amazing way. Just a glimpse, just a moment, but something amazing and unquestionable. Now it's back to the grind, back to the hard road, back to that path towards Jerusalem of carrying the cross. And so we come back to our own lives, our own condition, our own times of discouragement. And I think we have to ask why, where do we turn when we are struggling, when we are discouraged? How does this help us? Jesus met the discouragement of Peter, James, and John in a remarkable way. And I am sure that they kept that memory for the rest of their lives. They still struggled, of course, and we're going to see that as the story continues. But what about us? How does God encourage us when we are discouraged? I mean, there's no mount of transfiguration for you or I to climb. We can't just, you know, say, all right, this afternoon we're going to climb the mountain, we're going to see Jesus in all of his glory again, and then we'll get back to it on Monday. But here's the thing we need to know. What we need is to hold fast in faith. that what the disciples saw that day on the mountaintop was real. Okay? We have to hold fast that that was the reality. This was not a hallucination. This was not a hoax. It was real before they got there. It remained real after they left. That the transfiguration of Jesus wasn't something other, different, or beyond the world we inhabit today, but that what they saw is that the way things really are when the curtain is drawn back. That curtain being our sinfulness, our brokenness, the death-saturated reality of our daily lives that blocks our view. But when we believe and hold fast in faith that what the disciples saw that day on the mountain was real, then it's impossible to remain in a state of discouragement. Because when the awesome and transcendent and eternal glory of God grips our soul, discouragement's got to flee. Every disciple of Jesus has got to grab a hold of this truth. We cannot let go of it. And this is what the devil's always working overtime to try to get us to forget or to doubt or to question or to ignore. The devil only wants you to believe that what we feel and what we see in the moment of our discouragement is all there is or ever will be. That's his aim. That's what that tool of his is intended to do. But we have to see different. We have to see that what they saw is real. What they saw on that mountain is the way things truly are. Now, this past week, all the kids in CLC were learning about Corrie Ten Boom. I think I got a picture of her up here, if I can. There we go. I've talked about Corrie Ten Boom before. An incredible believer who saved hundreds of Jews during World War II, who was put in a Nazi concentration camp where the rest of her family died. She miraculously survived. But if anyone had reason to succumb to discouragement, it would be her. If anybody had reason to doubt the transfiguration of Jesus, that what they saw on that mountain was real, it would be her. Because it seemed like all she saw was darkness and death and destruction and evil. But I was encouraged this past Wednesday when my daughter Rosa came home from CLC with her little project that she did in the preschool class. And it had this little picture she colored with Corrie Ten Boom in it. And it had this quote from Corrie. And I thought, wow, that is such a great thing to remember. Corrie said this: "Let God's promises shine on your problems." Let God's promises shine on your problems. And you know, that might almost sound too simple or too trite, except it's coming from her. And I think she has a right to say this. And as I thought about it more, I realized that is so true. That's exactly what this transfiguration is about, that the glory of God's light in Jesus is shining on anything that might discourage these disciples. So if all the things that cause us to be discouraged are piled up on one side, and then the promises of God get piled up on the other, let those promises shine bright and cause us no longer to be overwhelmed by the things that so often discourage. Back to John Bloom's article that I mentioned earlier. He says this. He says, "Think of discouragement as your faith being choked." He says, "When you're choking, it's not time to plop down in front of the TV with a plate of comfort food to medicate your melancholy." He says, "You've got to dislodge the obstruction so that you can breathe. You need to fight for your life. You may need to get someone to give you the Heimlich." Now, did you think about that? The Heimlich. When I am discouraged, the first thing I think of needing isn't necessarily the Heimlich maneuver. But you do need a spiritual Heimlich, don't you? Instead of going for the comfort food, like he says here. We got to reopen the airway. We got to be able to breathe spiritually again. We've got to be able to pray. We've got to be able to read our Bible. We've got to have Christian fellowship that revives our heart again. And so it's some of those simple habits of prayer, Bible reading, worship. These are the things the devil prevents us, wants to prevent us from going to keep us discouraged, and to keep us off God's mission. So we counter that by refusing to give in. And when that sense of discouragement settles in, we got to not do what most people do, and that is kind of hunker down, hide, ignore it, try to just comfort our way out, but instead be aggressive, confront it, ask for help. Say, I need the Heimlich maneuver here. You know that symbol people do when they're choking. Maybe we need a spiritual way of doing that. But one more illustration here before closing. This past week, my girls went to the library, and they brought home a DVD about Ruby Bridges. And I don't know if it's because it's Black History Month. Maybe they had a display at the library while they were there. But how many of you know the story of Ruby Bridges? Some of you, maybe. There's a great children's book out there about her. And so whether you've read the book or maybe seen this movie, it's such an incredible story. I watched this with my daughters this week. And it's about the six-year-old girl, Ruby Bridges. Maybe you've seen the picture before. 1960, New Orleans. She took some kind of test, and they decided, well, she's pretty smart. And she's the one that we're going to have break the segregation barrier in the public schools in New Orleans in 1960. So her parents were, of course, obviously very reluctant to do this, but they finally agreed. And so in November of 1960, she pulled up to the front of this school in New Orleans that had previously been all white and was escorted by four U.S. Marshals up the big steps towards the front doors of this building and guided into the classroom. Well, there were protesters that lined both sides of the sidewalk leading up those steps, screaming horrible, terrible things at her, spitting, making death threats, and everything else that you can imagine. But she boldly marched up those steps and right into the school. As soon as she got into the school, all the other kids left. And for many, many days, she was the only child attending this school because nobody else would let their kids go if she was there. And so she sat in a classroom all by herself. She had a very dedicated teacher who poured a lot into her life that year. And slowly, a few kids started to come back, but they still wouldn't go into her classroom. So she sat all by herself in one desk. And a psychologist named Robert Coles took a special interest in Ruby Bridges. He started meeting with her each week because he knew this would have to be very stressful, a lot of trauma that she's enduring as a result of this. And he wanted to make sure she was okay and to walk her through this. And what he found in these conversations that he had with her was the profound role of her faith in Jesus. This six-year-old girl. Her family went to church each week. They prayed every night, and they read the Bible, and faith in Jesus was a part of her life and was a profound strength for her. And I just want to end with one point about her life that really stood out to me. It was depicted in this movie, that every day she would walk past these protesters. She had the marshals on all corners. They would tell her, just look straight ahead. Don't look to your left. Don't look to your right. Don't pay attention to anybody around you. Just go straight in the building. And she did this every day. And then one day, she got to the top of the steps of the school building. All those people yelling at her and shouting and picketing around her. And she turned around and she looked out on the crowd. And the marshals started to get scared. Well, this isn't part of the plan. She's not supposed to look at anybody. They were afraid something might go wrong. And she just looked at the crowd and she looked. And then they got her turned around and led into the school. And they said, Ruby, why did you do that? Why did you turn around and look at everybody all of a sudden? You know the rule. She said, well, every day as we drive to school, she said, and I see all those people gathered outside of the school, I pray for them. And she said, when I started up the steps today, I realized I had forgotten to pray before I got here. So I had to pray for them. And that's why she had turned. And as she looked at each of them, she was praying for them. A six-year-old girl. But do you think about how we overcome the things that could discourage and overwhelm us? It's those simple things that keep the airway open, the path of God's grace and the power of prayer. Heavenly Father, I pray that you will help each of us in our times of discouragement, when it seems like everything is crashing in and everyone might be against us and we're just overwhelmed and there's no point in going forward. Help us to identify this as a tool of the devil and to seek the help we need to open up that airway, to pray, to receive your word, to be in fellowship, and to go back to those basics that are so essential to bring life again to our soul. Help us to see that what those disciples saw was real, and that you shine brightly on all our problems. In Jesus' name, amen.